should create a natural phenomenon. This had better stop right here, I thought. My head was getting lighter and my chest felt tight. Look, I said, an unarmed man was killed, a brother, a leading member shot down by a policeman. We had lost our prestige in the community. I saw the chance to rally the people, so I acted. If that was incorrect, then I did wrong. So say it straight without this crap. It'll take more than sarcasm to deal with the crowd out there. Brother Jack reddened. The others exchanged glances. He hasn't read the newspapers, someone said. You forget, Brother Jack said. It wasn't necessary. He was there. Yes, I was there, I said, if you're referring to the killing. There, you see, Brother Jack said. He was on the scene. Brother Tobit pushed the table edge with his palms. And still you organized that sideshow of a funeral. My nose twitched. I turned to him deliberately, forcing a grin. How could there be a sideshow without you as the star attraction? Who draw the two bits? Admission, Brother Two Bits. What was wrong with the funeral? Now we're making progress, Brother Jack said, straddling his chair. The strategist has raised a very interesting question. What's wrong, he asks. All right, I'll answer. Under your leadership, a traitorous merchant of vile instruments of anti-Negro, anti-minority, racist bigotry has received the funeral of a hero. Do you still ask what's wrong? But nothing was done about a traitor, I said. He half stood, gripping the back of his chair. We all heard you admit it. We dramatized the shooting down of an unarmed black man. He threw up his hands. To hell with you, I thought. To hell with you. He was a man. That black man, as you call him, was a traitor, Brother Jack said. A traitor. What is a traitor, brother? I asked, feeling an angry amusement as I counted on my fingers. He was a man and a Negro, a man and a brother, a man and a traitor, as you say. Then he was a dead man, and alive or dead, he was jam full of contradictions, so full that he attracted half of Harlem to come out and stand in the sun in answer to our call. So what is a traitor? So now he retreats, Brother Jack said. Observe him, brothers. After putting the movement in the position of forcing a traitor down the throats of the Negroes, he asks what a traitor is. Yes, I said, yes. And as you say, it's a fair question, brother. Some folks call me a traitor because I've been working downtown. Some would call me a traitor if I was in civil service, and others if I simply sat in my corner and kept quiet. Sure, I considered what Clifton did, and you defend him. Not for that. I was as disgusted as you. But hell, isn't the shooting of an unarmed man of more importance politically than the fact that he sold obscene dolls? So you exercised your personal responsibility, Jack said. That's all I had to go on. I wasn't called to the strategy meeting, remember?
Didn't you see what you were playing with, Tobit said? Have you no respect for your people?
It was a dangerous mistake to give you the opportunity, one of the others said. I looked across at him. The committee can take it away if it wishes, but meantime, why is everyone so upset? If even one-tenth of the people looked at the dolls as we do, our work would be a lot easier. The dolls are nothing.
Nothing, Jack said. That nothing might explode in our face.
I sighed. Your faces are safe, brother, I said. Can't you see that they don't think in such abstract terms? If they did, perhaps the new program wouldn't have flopped. The Brotherhood isn't the Negro people. No organization is. All you see in Clifton's death is that it might harm the prestige of the Brotherhood. You see him only as a traitor, but Harlem doesn't react that way.
Now he's lecturing us on the conditioned reflexes of the Negro people, Tobit said.
I looked at him. I was very tired. And what is the source of your great contributions to the movement, brother? A career in burlesque and of your profound knowledge of Negroes? Are you from an old plantation-owning family? Does your black mammy shuffle nightly through your dreams? He opened his mouth and closed it like a fish.
I'll have you know that I'm married to a fine, intelligent Negro girl, he said.
So that's what makes you so cocky, I thought, seeing now how the light struck him at an angle and made a wedged-shaped shadow beneath his nose. So that's it. And how did I guess there was a woman in it? Brother, I apologize, I said. I misjudged you. You have our number. In fact, you must be practically a Negro yourself. Was it by immersion or injection?
Now see here, he said, pushing back his chair.
Come on, I thought, just make a move, just another little move.
Brothers,
Jack said, his eyes on me. Let's stick to the discussion. I'm intrigued, you were saying.
I watched Tobit. He glared. I grinned.
I was saying that up here, we know that the policeman didn't care about Clifton's ideas. He was shot because he was black and because he resisted, mainly because he was black.
Brother Jack frowned. You're riding race again. But how do they feel about the dolls?
I'm riding the race I'm forced to ride, I said. And as for the dolls, they know that as far as the cops are concerned, Clifton could have been selling song sheets, Bibles, matzahs. If he had been white, he'd be alive. Or if he'd accepted being pushed around,
black and white and black, Tobit said, must we listen to this racist nonsense?
You don't, Brother Negro, I said. You get your own information straight from the source. Is it a mulatto source, brother? Oh, don't answer. The only thing wrong is that your source is too narrow. You don't really think the crowd turned out today because Clifton was a member of the Brotherhood.
And why did they turn out? Jack said, getting set as if to pounce forward.
Because we gave them the opportunity to express their feelings, to affirm themselves.
Brother Jack rubbed his eye. Do you know that you have become quite a theoretician, he said? You astound me.
I doubt that, brother, but there's nothing like isolating a man to make him think, I said.
Yes, that's true. Some of our best ideas have been thought in prison, only you haven't been in prison, brother, and you were not hired to think. Have you forgotten that?
If so, listen to me. You were not hired to think.
He was speaking very deliberately, and I thought, so. So here it is, naked and old and rotten. So now it's out in the open.
So now I know where I am, I said.
And with whom?
Don't twist my meaning. For all of us, the committee does the thinking. For all of us. And you were hired to talk.
That's right. I was hired. Things have been so brotherly I'd forgotten my place.
But what if I wish to express an idea?
We furnish all ideas. We have some acute ones. Ideas are part of our apparatus. Only the correct ideas for the correct occasion.
And suppose you misjudge the occasion.
Should that ever happen, you keep quiet. Even though I am correct, you say nothing unless it is passed by the committee. Otherwise, I suggest you keep saying the last thing you were told.
And when my people demand that I speak,
the committee will have an answer.
I looked at him. The room was hot, quiet, smoky. The others looked at me strangely. I heard the nervous sound of someone mashing out a cigarette in a glass ashtray. I pushed back my chair, breathing deeply, controlled. I was on a dangerous road, and I thought of Clifton and tried to get off of it. I said nothing. Suddenly Jack smiled and slipped back into his fatherly role.
Let us handle the theory and the business of strategy, he said. We're experienced. We're graduates, and while you are a smart beginner, you skipped several grades. But they were important grades, especially for gaining strategical knowledge. For such, it is necessary to see the overall picture. More is involved than meets the eye. With the long view and the short view and the overall view mastered, perhaps you won't slander the political consciousness of the people of Harlem.
Can't he see I'm trying to tell them what's real, I thought? Does my membership stop me from feeling Harlem?
All right, I said. Have it your way, brother. Only the political consciousness of Harlem is exactly a thing I know something about. That's one class they wouldn't let me skip. I'm describing a part of reality which I know.
And that is the most questionable statement of all, Tobit said.
I know, I said, running my thumb along the edge of the table. Your private source tells you differently. History's made at night, eh, brother?
I warn you, Tobit said.
Brother to brother, brother, I said. Try getting around more. You might learn that today was the first time that they've listened to our appeals in weeks. And I'll tell you something else. If we don't follow through on what was done today, this might be the last...
So he's finally gotten around to predicting the future, Brother Jack said.
It's possible, though I hope not.
He's in touch with God, Tobit said. The black God.
I looked at him and grinned. He had gray eyes, and his irises were very wide, the muscles ridged out on his jaws. I had his guard down, and he was swinging wild.
Not with God, nor with your wife, brother, I told him. I've never met either, but I've worked with the people up here. Ask your wife to take you around to the gin mills and the barber shops and the juke joints and the churches, brother. Yes, the beauty parlors on Saturdays when they're frying hair. A whole unrecorded history is spoken then, brother. You wouldn't believe it, but it's true. Tell her to take you to stand in the areaway of a cheap tenement at night and listen to what is said. Put her on the corner, let her tell you what's being put down. You'll learn that a lot of people are angry because we failed to lead them in action. I'll stand on that as I stand on what I see and feel and on what I've heard and what I know.
No, Brother Jack said, getting to his feet. You'll stand on the decision of the committee. We've had enough of this. The committee makes your decisions, and it is not its practice to give undue importance to the mistaken notions of the people. What's happened to your discipline?
I'm not arguing against discipline. I'm trying to be useful. I'm trying to point out a part of reality which the committee seems to have missed. With just one demonstration, we could...
The committee has decided against such demonstrations, Brother Jack said. Such methods are no longer effective.
Something seemed to move out from under me, and out of the corner of my eye, I was suddenly aware of objects on the dark side of the hall. But didn't anyone see what happened today, I said? What was that, a dream? What was ineffective about that crowd?
Such crowds are only our raw materials, one of the raw materials to be shaped to our program.
I looked around the table and shook my head. No wonder they insult me and accuse us of betraying them.
There was a sudden movement. Repeat that, Brother Jack shouted, stepping forward. It's true. I'll repeat it. Until this afternoon, they've been saying that the Brotherhood betrayed them.
I'm telling you what's been said to me, and that is why Brother Clifton disappeared.
That's an indefensible lie, Brother Jack said.
And I looked at him slowly, now thinking, if this is it, this is it. Don't call me that, I said softly. Don't ever call me that. None of you. I've told you what I've heard.
My hand was in my pocket now, Brother Tarp's leg chain around my knuckles. I looked at each of them individually, trying to hold myself back and yet feeling it getting away from me. My head was whirling as though I were riding a supersonic merry-go-round. Jack looked at me, a new interest behind his eyes, leaned forward.
So, you've heard it, he said. Very well. So now hear this. We do not shape our policies to the mistaken and infantile notions of the man in the street. Our job is not to ask them what they think, but to tell them.
You've said that, I said, and that's the one thing you can tell them yourself.
Who are you, anyway? The great white father? Not their father, their leader, and your leader, and don't forget it.
My leader, sure, but what's your exact relationship to them?
His red head bristled.
The leader. As leader of the Brotherhood, I am their leader.
But are you sure you aren't their great white father? I said, watching him closely, aware of the hot silence and feeling tension race from my toes to my legs as I drew my feet quickly beneath me. Wouldn't it be better if they called you Massa Jack?
Now see here, he began, leaping to his feet to lean across the table, and I spun my chair half around on its hind legs as he came between me and the light, gripping the edge of the table, spluttering and lapsing into a foreign language, choking and coughing and shaking his head as I balanced on my toes now set to propel myself forward, seeing him above me and the others behind him as suddenly something seemed to erupt out of his face. You're seeing things, I thought, hearing it strike sharply against the table and roll as his arm shot out and snatched an object the size of a large marble and dropped it, plop, into his glass. And I could see the water shooting up in a ragged, light-breaking pattern to spring in swift droplets across the oiled tabletop. The room seemed to flatten. I shot to a high plateau above them and down, feeling the jolt on the end of my spine as the chair legs struck the floor. The merry-go-round had speeded up. I heard his voice, but no longer listened. I stared at the glass, seeing how the light shone through, throwing a transparent, precisely fluted shadow against the dark grain of the table. And there, on the bottom of the glass, lay an eye. A glass eye. A buttermilk white eye distorted by the light rays. An eye! Staring fixedly at me as from the dark waters of a well.
Then I was looking at him standing above me, outlined by the light against the darkened half of the hall.
You must accept discipline. Either you accept decisions or you get out.
I stared into his face, feeling a sense of outrage. His left eye had collapsed, a line of raw redness showing where the lid refused to close, and his gaze had lost its command. I looked from his face to the glass, thinking he's disemboweled himself just in order to confound me. And the others had known it all along. They aren't even surprised. I stared at the eye, aware of Jack pacing up and down, shouting.
Brother, are you following me? He stopped, squinting at me with cyclopean irritation. What's the matter?
I stared up at him, unable to answer. Then he understood and approached the table, smiling maliciously.
So that's it. So it makes you uncomfortable, does it? You're a sentimentalist, he said, sweeping up the glass and causing the eye to turn over in the water so that now it seemed to peer down at me from the ringed bottom of the glass.
He smiled, holding the tumbler level with his empty socket, swirling the glass.
You didn't know about this?
No, and I didn't want to know. Someone laughed.
See, that demonstrates how long you've been with us. He lowered the glass. I lost my eye in the line of duty. What do you think of that?
He said with a pride that made me all the angrier.
I don't give a damn how you lost it, as long as you keep it hidden. That is because you don't appreciate the meaning of sacrifice. I was ordered to carry through an objective, and I carried it through, understand, even though I had to lose my eye to do it.
He was gloating now, holding up the eye in the glass as though it were a medal of merit.
Not much like that traitor Clifton, is it? Tobit said.
The others were amused.
All right, I said, all right. It was a heroic act. It saved the world. Now hide the bleeding wound.
Don't over-evaluate it, Jack said quieter now. The heroes are those who die. This was nothing. After it happened, a minor lesson in discipline. And do you know what discipline is? Brother, personal responsibility. It's sacrifice. 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 He slammed the glass upon the table, splashing the water on the back of my hand. I shook like a leaf. So that is the meaning of discipline, I thought. Sacrifice. Yes, and blindness. He doesn't see me. He doesn't even see me. Am I about to strangle him? I don't know. He cannot possibly, I still do not know. See! Discipline is sacrifice, yes, and blindness, yes, and me sitting here while he tries to intimidate me. That's it, with his goddamn blind glass eye. Should you show him you get it? Shouldn't you? Shouldn't he know it? Hurry! Shouldn't you? Look at it there, a good job, an almost perfect imitation that seemed alive. Should you? Shouldn't you? Maybe he got to where he learned that language he lapsed into. Shouldn't you? Make him speak the unknown tongue, the language of the future? What's mattering with you? Discipline is learning, didn't he say? Is it? I stand. You're sitting here, ain't I? You're holding on, ain't I? He said you'd learn, so you're learning, so he saw it all the time. He's a riddler. Shouldn't we show him? So, sit still is the way. And learn. Never mind the eye. It's dead. All right, now look at him. See him turning now, left, right, coming short-legged toward you? See him?
Hep, hep.
The one-eyed beacon. All right. All right.
Hep, hep.
Short-legged deacon. All right, nail him. Short-changing dialectical deacon. All right. There, so now you're learning. Get it under control. Patience. Yes. I looked at him again as for the first time, seeing a little bantam rooster of a man with a high-domed forehead and a raw eye socket that wouldn't quite accept its lid. I looked at him carefully now, with some of the red spots fading and with the feeling that I was just awakening from a dream. I had boomeranged around. I realize how you feel, he said, becoming an actor who just finished a part in a play and was speaking again in his natural voice. I remember the first time I saw myself this way, and it wasn't pleasant. And don't think I wouldn't rather have my old one back. He felt in the water for his eye now, and I could see its smooth, half-spherical, half-amorphous form slip between his two fingers and spurt around the glass as though looking for a way to break out. Then he had it, shaking off the water and breathing upon it as he walked across to the dark side of the room. But who knows, brothers, he said, with his back turned. Perhaps if we do our work successfully, the new society will provide me with a living eye. Such a thing is not at all fantastic, although I've been without mine for quite a while. What time is it, by the way? But what kind of society will make him see me, I thought, hearing Tobin answer, 6:15. Then we'd better leave immediately. We've got a long way to travel, he said, coming across the floor. He had his eye in place now, and he was smiling. How's that? He asked me. I nodded. I was very tired. I simply nodded. Good, he said. I sincerely hope it never happens to you. Sincerely. If it should, maybe you'll recommend me to your oculist, I said. Then I may not see myself as others see me not. He looked at me oddly, then laughed. See, brothers, he's joking. He feels brotherly again. But just the same, I hope you'll never need one of these. Meanwhile, go and see Hambro. He'll outline the program and give you the instructions. As for today, just let things float. It is a development that is important only if we make it so. Otherwise, it will be forgotten, he said, getting into his jacket. And you'll see that it's best. The Brotherhood must act as a coordinated unit. I looked at him. I was becoming aware of smells again, and I needed a bath. The others were standing now, and moving toward the door, I stood up, feeling the shirt stick to my back. One last thing, Jack said, placing his hand on my shoulder and speaking quietly. Watch that temper. That's discipline, too. Learn to demolish your brotherly opponents with ideas, with polemical skill. The other is for our enemies. Save it for them. And go and get some rest. I was beginning to tremble. His face seemed to advance and recede and advance. He shook his head and smiled grimly. I know how you feel, he said, and it's too bad all that effort was for nothing. But that in itself is a kind of discipline. I speak to you of what I've learned, and I'm a great deal older than you. Good night. I looked at his eye. So he knows how I feel. Which eye is really the blind one? Good night, I said. Good night, brother, they all, except Tobit, said. It'll be night, but it won't be good, I thought, calling a final. Good night! They left, and I took my jacket and went and sat at my desk. I heard them passing down the stairs and the closing of the door below. I felt as though I'd been watching a bad comedy, only it was real, and I was living it. And it was the only historically meaningful life that I could live. If I left it, I'd be nowhere, as dead and as meaningless as Clifton. I felt for the doll in the shadow and dropped it on the desk. He was dead, all right, and nothing would come of his death now. He was useless even for a scavenger action. He had waited too long. The directives had changed on him. He'd barely gotten by with a funeral. And that was all. It was only a matter of a few days, but he had missed, and there was nothing I could do. But at least he was dead and out of it. I sat there a while, growing wilder and fighting against it. I couldn't leave, and I had to keep contact in order to fight. But I would never be the same, never. After tonight, I wouldn't ever look the same or feel the same. Just what I'd be, I didn't know. I couldn't go back to what I was, which wasn't much, but I'd lost too much to be what I was. Some of me, too, had died with Todd Clifton. So, I would see Hambro for whatever it was worth. I got up and went out into the hall. The glass was still on the table, and I swept it across the room, hearing it rumble and roll in the dark. Then I went downstairs. The bar downstairs was hot and crowded, and there was a heated argument in progress over Clifton's shooting. I stood near the door and ordered a bourbon. Then someone noticed me, and they tried to draw me in. Please. Not tonight, I said. He was one of my best friends.
Oh, sure, they said.
And I had another bourbon and left. When I reached 125th Street, I was approached by a group of civil liberties workers circulating a petition demanding the dismissal of the guilty policeman. And a block further on, even the familiar Woman Street preacher was shouting a sermon about the slaughter of the innocents. A much broader group was stirred up over the shooting than I had imagined. Good, I thought. Perhaps it won't die down after all. Maybe I'd better see Hambro tonight. Little groups were all along the street, and I moved with increasing speed until suddenly I had reached 7th Avenue, and there beneath a street lamp with the largest crowd around him was Ross the Exhorter, the last man in the world I wanted to see. And I had just turned back when I saw him lean down between his flags, shouting,
"Look! Look, black ladies and gentlemen! There goes the representative of the Brotherhood! Does Ross see correctly? Is that gentleman trying to pass us unnoticed? Ask him about it. What are you people waiting for, sir? What are you doing about your black youth shot down because of your deceitful organization?"
They turned, looking at me, closing in. Some came up behind me and tried to push me further into the crowd. The exhorter leaned down, pointing at me beneath the green traffic light.
"Ask him what they are doing about it, ladies and gentlemen. Are they afraid? Or are the white folks and their black stooges sticking together to betray us?"
"Get your hands off me," I shouted as someone reached around and seized my arm. I heard a voice cursing me softly.
"Give the brother a chance to answer,"
someone said. Their faces pressed in upon me. I wanted to laugh, for suddenly I realized that I didn't know whether I had been part of a sellout or not. But they were in no mood for laughter. "Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters," I said, "I disdain to answer such an attack. Since you all know me and my work, I don't think it's necessary. But it seems highly dishonorable to use the unfortunate death of one of our most promising young men as an excuse for attacking an organization that has worked to bring an end to such outrages. Who was the first organization to act against this killing? The Brotherhood. Who was the first to arouse the people? The Brotherhood. Who will always be the first to advance the cause of the people? Again, the Brotherhood. We acted, and we shall always act, I assure you. But in our own disciplined way, and we will act positively. We refuse to waste our energy and yours in premature and ill-considered actions. We are Americans, all of us, whether black or white, regardless of what the man on the ladder there tells you, Americans. And we leave it to the gentleman up there to abuse the name of the dead. The Brotherhood grieves and feels deeply the loss of its brother. And we are determined that his death shall be the beginning of profound and lasting changes. It's easy enough to wait around for the minute a man is safely buried and then stand on a ladder and smear the memory of everything he believed in. But to create something lasting of his death takes time and careful planning.
Gentlemen, Ross shouted, stick to the issue. You're not answering my question. What are you doing about the shooting?
I moved toward the edge of the crowd. If this went any further, it could be disastrous. Stop abusing the dead for your own selfish ends, I said. Let him rest in peace. Quit mangling his corpse. I pushed away as he raged, hearing shouts of,
tell him about it, grave robber!
The exhorter waved his arms and pointed, shouting,
that man is a paid stooge of the white enslaver. Where has he been for the last few months when our black babies and women have been suffering?
Let the dead rest in peace, I shouted, hearing someone call. Oh, man, go back to Africa. Everybody knows the brother.
Good, I thought. Good. Then there was a scuffle behind me, and I whirled to see two men stop short. They were Ross's men.
Listen, mister, I said up to him. If you know what's good for you, you'll call off your goons. Two of them seem to want to follow me.
And that is a damn lie, he shouted.
There are witnesses if anything should happen to me. A man who'll dig up the dead hardly before he's buried will try anything. But I warn you,
there were angry shouts from some of the crowd, and I saw the men continue past me with hate in their eyes, leaving the crowd to disappear around the corner. Ross was attacking the Brotherhood now, and others were answering him from the audience. And I went on, moving back toward Lenox, moving past a movie house when they grabbed me and started punching me. But this time they picked the wrong spot, and the movie doorman intervened, and they ran back toward Ross's street meeting. I thanked the doorman and went on. I had been lucky. They hadn't hurt me, but Ross was becoming bold again. On a less crowded street, they might have done some damage. Reaching the avenue, I stepped to the curb and signaled a cab, seeing it sail by. An ambulance went past, then another cab with its flag down. I looked back. I felt that they were watching me from somewhere up the street, but I couldn't see them. Why didn't a taxi come? Then three men in natty cream-colored summer suits came to stand near me at the curb, and something about them struck me like a hammer. They were all wearing dark glasses. I had seen it thousands of times, but suddenly, what I had considered an empty imitation of a Hollywood fad was flooded with personal significance. Why not, I thought, why not? And shot across the street and into the air-conditioned chill of a drugstore. I saw them on a case strewn with sun visors, hair nets, rubber gloves, a card of false eyelashes, and seized the darkest lenses I could find. They were of a green glass, so dark that it appeared black, and I put them on immediately, plunging into blackness and moving outside. I could barely see. It was almost dark now, and the streets swarmed in a green vagueness. I moved slowly across to stand near the subway and wait for my eyes to adjust. A strange wave of excitement boiled within me as I peered out at the sinister light. And now, through the hot gusts from the underground, people were emerging and I could feel the trains vibrating the walk. A cab rolled up to discharge a passenger, and I was about to take it when the woman came up the stairs and stopped before me smiling. Now what, I thought, seeing her standing there, smiling in her tight-fitting summer dress, a large young woman who reeked with Christmas night perfume, who now came close.
"Reinhard, baby, is that you?" she said.
Reinhard, I thought. So it works. She had her hand on my arm, and faster than I thought, I heard myself answer, "Is that you, baby?" and waited with tense breath.
"Well, for once you're on time," she said. "But what you doing bareheaded? Where's your new hat I bought you?"
I wanted to laugh. The scent of Christmas night was enfolding me now when I saw her face draw closer, her eyes widening.
"Say, you ain't Reinhard, man. What you trying to do? You don't even talk like Ryan. What's your story?"
I laughed, backing away. Well, I guess we were both mistaken, I said. She stepped backward, clutching her bag, watching me, confused. I really meant no harm, I said. I'm sorry. Who is it you mistook me for?
Reinhard. And you better not let him catch you pretending to be him.
No, I said, but, you seem so pleased to see him that I couldn't resist it. He's really a lucky man.
And I could have sworn you was... Man, you get away from here before you get me in trouble, she said,
moving aside, and I left. It was very strange. But that about the hat was a good idea, I thought, hurrying along now and looking out for Ross's men. I was wasting time. At the first hat shop, I went in and bought the widest hat in stock and put it on. With this, I thought, I should be seen even in a snowstorm. Only they'd think I was someone else. Then I was back in the street and moving toward the subway. My eyes adjusted quickly. The world took on a dark green intensity. The lights of cars glowed like stars. Faces were a mysterious blur. The garish signs of movie houses muted down to a soft, sinister glowing. I headed back to Ross's meeting with a bold swagger. This is the real test. If it worked, I would go on to Hambro's without further trouble. In the angry period to come, I would be able to move about. A couple of men approached, eating up the walk with long, jaunty strides that caused their heavy silk sport shirts to flounce rhythmically upon their bodies. They, too, wore dark glasses. Their hats were set high upon their heads, the brims turned down. A couple of hipsters, I thought, just as they spoke.
"What you saying, daddy-o?"
they said.
"Reinhard, Papa, tell us what you putting down," they said.
Oh, hell. Probably his friends, I thought, waving and moving on.
"We know what you doing, Reinhard," one of them called. "Play it cool, old man, play it cool."
I waved again as though in on the joke. They laughed behind me. I was nearing the end of the block now, wet with sweat. Who was this Reinhard and what was he putting down? I'd have to learn more about him to avoid further misidentifications. A car passed with its radio blaring. Ahead I could hear the exhorter barking harshly to the crowd. Then I was moving close, and coming to a stop conspicuously in the space left for pedestrians to pass through the crowd. To the rear, they were lined up too deep before the store windows. Before me, the listeners merged in a green-tinted gloom. The exhorter gestured violently, blasting the Brotherhood.
"The time for auction is here! We must chase them out of Harlem," he cried.
And for a second I thought he had caught me in the sweep of his eyes and tensed.
"Ross said chase them. It is time Ross the Exhorter become Ross the Destroyer."
Shouts of agreement arose and I looked behind me, seeing the men who had followed me and thinking, what did he mean, destroyer?
"I repeat, black ladies and gentlemen, the time has come for action. I, Ross the Destroyer, repeat, the time has come."
I trembled with excitement. They hadn't recognized me. It works, I thought. They see the hat, not me. There is a magic in it. It hides me right in front of their eyes. But suddenly I wasn't sure. With Ross calling for the destruction of everything white in Harlem, who could notice me? I needed a better test. If I was to carry out my plan... What plan? Hell, I don't know. Come on. I weaved out of the crowd and left, heading for Hambro's. A group of zoot suiters greeted me in passing.
"Hey, hey, now, daddy-o," they call. "Hey, hey, 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 now."
"Hey, hey, hey, now," I said. It was as though by dressing and walking in a certain way, I had enlisted in a fraternity in which I was recognized at a glance. Not by features, but by clothes, by uniform, by gait. But this gave rise to another uncertainty. I was not a zoot suiter, but a kind of politician. Or was I? What would happen in a real test? What about the fellows who'd been insulting at the Jolly Dollar? I was halfway across 8th Avenue at the thought, and retraced my steps, running for an uptown bus. There were many of the regular customers draped around the bar. The room was crowded, and Barrel House was on duty. I could feel the frame of the glasses cutting into the ridge of my nose as I tilted my hat and squeezed up to the bar. Barrelhouse looked at me roughly, his lips pushed out.
"What brand you drinking tonight, Papa Stopper?"
he said. "Make it Ballantine's," I said in my natural voice. I watched his eyes as he set the beer before me and slapped the bar with his enormous hand for his money. Then, my heart beating faster, I made my old gesture of payment, spinning the coin upon the bar, and waited. The coin disappeared into his fist.
"Thanks, Pops,"
he said, moving on and leaving me puzzled. For there had been recognition of a kind in his voice, but not for me. He never called me Pops or Papa Stopper. It's working, I thought, perhaps. It's working very well. Certainly something was working on me, and profoundly. Still, I was relieved. It was hot. Perhaps that was it. I drank the cold beer, looking back to the rear of the room, to the booths. A crowd of men and women moiled like nightmare figures in the smoke-green haze. The jukebox was dinning, and it was like looking into the depths of a murky cave. And now someone moved aside, and looking down along the curve of the bar past the bobbing heads and shoulders, I saw the jukebox, lit up like a bad dream of the fiery furnace, shouting, "Jelly, jelly, jelly, all night long." And yet, I thought, watching a numbers runner paying off a bet, this is one place that the Brotherhood definitely penetrated. Let Hambro explain that, too, along with all the rest he'd have to explain. I drained the glass and turned to leave, when there across the lunch counter I saw Brother Maceo. I moved impulsively, forgetting my disguise until almost upon him, then checked myself and put my disguise once more to a test. Reaching roughly across his shoulder, I picked up a greasy menu that rested between the sugar shaker and the hot sauce bottle and pretended to read it through my dark glasses. "How are the ribs, Pops?" I said.
"Fine, least these here I'm eating is."
"Yeah? How much you know about ribs?" He raised his head slowly, looking across at the spitted chickens revolving before the low, blue rotisserie flames.
"I reckon I know as much about 'em as you," he said, "and probably more, since I've probably been eating 'em a few years longer than you, and in a few more places. What makes you think you can come in here messing with me anyhow?"
He turned, looking straight into my face, now challenging me. He was very game, and I wanted to laugh.
"Oh, take it easy," I growled. "A man can ask a question, can he?"
"You got your answer,"
he said, turning completely around on the stool.
"So now I guess you ready to pull your knife."
"Knife," I said, wanting to laugh. "Who said anything about a knife?"
That's what you're thinking about. Somebody say something that you don't like and you kind of fellas pull your switchblades. So, all right, go ahead and pull it. I'm as ready to die as I'm going ever be. Let's see you. Go ahead.
He reached for the sugar shaker now, and I stood there feeling suddenly that the old man before me was not Brother Maseo at all, but someone else disguised to confuse me. The glasses were working too well. He's a game, old brother, I thought, but this'll never do. I pointed toward his plate. I asked you about the ribs, I said. Not your ribs. Who said anything about a knife?
Never mind that. Just go on and pull it, he said. Let's see you. Or is you waiting for me to turn my back? All right, here it is. Here's my back,
he said, turning swiftly on the stool and around again, his arms set to throw the shaker. Customers were turning to look, were moving clear.
What's the matter, Maseo?
Someone said.
Nothing I can't handle. This confidence-in son of a bitch come in here bluffing.
You take it easy, old man, I said. Don't let your mouth get your head in trouble, thinking, why am I talking like this?
You don't have to worry about that, son of a bitch. Pull your switchblade. Give it to him, Maseo. Cool, crack that mother fowler.
I marked the position of the voice by ear now, turning so that I could see Maseo, the agitator, and the customers blocking the door. Even the jukebox had stopped, and I could feel the danger mounting so swiftly that I moved without thinking, bounding over quickly and sweeping up a beer bottle, my body trembling. All right, I said, if that's the way you want it, all right. The next one who talks out of turn gets this. Maseo moved, and I fainted with the bottle. Seeing him dodge, his arm set to throw and held only because I was crowding him. A dark old man in overalls and a gray, long-billed cloth cap who looked dreamlike through the green glasses. Throw it, I said. Go on, overcome with the madness of the thing. Here I'd set out to test a disguise on a friend, and now I was ready to beat him to his knees, not because I wanted to, but because of place and circumstance. Okay, it was absurd, and yet real and dangerous, and if he moved, I'd let him have it as brutally as possible. To protect myself, I'd have to, or the drunks would gang me. Maseo was set, looking at me coldly, and suddenly I heard a voice boom out, "Ain't gonna be no fighting in my joint." It was Barrel House. "Put them things down, y'all. They cost money."
"Hell, Barrel House, let them fight."
"They can fight in the streets, not in here. Hey, y'all," he called. "Look over here."
I saw him now, leaning forward with a pistol in his huge fist, resting it steady upon the bar.
"Now put them down, y'all,"
he said mournfully.
"I done ask you to put my property down."
Brother Maseo looked from me to Barrel House. "Put it down, old man," I said, thinking, why am I acting from pride when this is not really me?
"You put y'all down," he said.
"Both y'all put them down. And you, Reinhardt,"
Barrel House said, gesturing at me with the pistol,
"you get out of my joint and stay out. We don't need your money in here."
I started to protest, but he held up his palm.
"Now, you all right with me, Reinhardt, don't get me wrong, but I just can't stand trouble,"
Barrel House said. Brother Maseo had replaced the shaker now, and I put my bottle down and backed to the door.
"And Ryan,"
Barrel House said,
"don't try to pull no pistol neither, 'cause this here one is loaded, and I got a permit."
I backed to the door, my scalp prickling, watching them both.
"Next time, don't ask no questions you don't want answered," Maseo called. "And if you ever want to finish this argument, I'll be right here."
I felt the outside air explode around me, and I stood just beyond the door, laughing with the sudden relief of the joke restored. Looking back at the defiant old man in his long-billed cap and the confounded eyes of the crowd, "Reinhardt? Reinhardt?" I thought, "what kind of man is Reinhardt?" I was still chuckling when, in the next block, I waited for the traffic lights near a group of men who stood on the corner, passing a bottle of cheap wine between them, as they discussed Clifton's murder.
What we need is some guns," one of them said. "An eye for an eye."
"Hell yes, machine guns. Pass me the Sneaky Pete, McElroy."
"Wasn't for that Sullivan law, this here New York wouldn't be nothing but a shooting gallery,"
another man said.
"Here's the Sneaky Pete, and don't try to find no home in that bottle."
"It's the only home I got, McElroy.
You want to take that away from me?"
"Man, drink up and pass the damn bottle."
I started around them, hearing one of them say,
"What you saying, Mr. Reinhardt? How's your hammer hanging?"
Even up here, I thought, beginning to hurry.
"Heavy, man," I said, knowing the answer to that one. "Very heavy."
They laughed.
Well, it'll be lighter by morning. Say, looky here, Mr. Reinhardt. How about giving me a job?
One of them said, approaching me, and I waved and crossed the street, walking rapidly down 8th toward the next bus stop. The shops and groceries were dark now, and children were running and yelling along the walks, dodging in and out among the adults. I walked, struck by the merging fluidity of forms seen through the lenses. Could this be the way the world appeared to Reinhardt? All the dark glass boys? For now we see as through a glass darkly, but then... I couldn't remember the rest. She was carrying a shopping bag and moved gingerly on her feet. Until she touched my arm, I thought that she was talking to herself.
I say, pardon me, son. Look like you're trying to pass on by me tonight. What's the final figure?
Figure? What figure?
Now you know what I mean,
she said, her voice rising as she put her hands on her hips and looked forward.
I mean today's last number. Ain't you Ryan the Runner?
Ryan the Runner?
Yes, Reinhardt, the number man. Who you trying to fool?
But that's not my name, madam, I said, speaking as precisely as I could, stepping away from her. You've made a mistake. Her mouth fell wide.
You ain't? Well, why, you look so much like him,
she said with hot doubt in her voice.
Now, ain't this here something? Let me go on home. If my dream come out, I'm gonna have to look that rascal up, and here I needs that money, too.
I hope you won, I said, straining to see her clearly, and I hope he pays off.
Thanks, son, but he'll pay off all right. I can see you ain't Reinhardt now, though. I'm sorry for stopping you.
It's all right, I said.
If I'd looked at your shoes, I would have known.
Why?
Because Ryan the Runner is known for them knob-toed kind.
I watched her limp away, rocking like the old ship of Zion. No wonder everyone knows him, I thought. In that racket, you have to get around. I was aware of my black and white shoes for the first time since the day of Clifton's shooting. When the squad car veered close to the curb and rolled along slowly beside me, I knew what was coming before the cop opened his mouth.
That you, Reinhardt? My man?
The cop who was not driving said. He was white. I could see the shield gleaming on his cap, but the number was vague.
Not this time, officer, I said. The hell you say? What are you trying to pull? Is this a holdout?
You're making a mistake, I said. I'm not, Reinhardt. The car stopped. A flashlight beamed in my green-lensed eyes. He spat into the street.
Well, you better be by morning, he said, and you better have our cut in the regular place. Who the hell you think you are? He called as the car speeded up and away.
And before I could turn, a crowd of men ran up from the corner pool hall. One of them carried an automatic in his hand.
What were these sons of bitches trying to do to you, Daddy?
He said. It was nothing. They thought I was someone else.
Who'd they take you for?
I looked at them. Were they criminals or simply men who were worked up over the shooting? Some guy named Reinhardt, I said.
Reinhardt? Hey, y'all hear that? Snorted the fellow with the gun. Reinhardt, them patties must be going stone blind. Anybody can see you ain't Reinhardt. But he do look like Ryan,
another man said, staring at me with his hands in his trousers pockets.
Like hell he does. Hell, man, Reinhardt will be driving that Cadillac this time of night. What the hell you talking about?
Listen, Jack,
the fellow with the gun said,
don't let nobody make you act like Reinhardt. You got to have a smooth tongue, a heartless heart, and be ready to do anything. If them patties bother you again, just let us know. We aim to stop some of this head whooping they've been doing.
Sure, I said.
Reinhardt, he said. Ain't that a bitch?
They turned and went arguing back to the pool hall, and I hurried out of the neighborhood. Having forgotten Hambro for the moment, I walked east instead of west. I wanted to remove the glasses, but decided against it. Ross's men might still be on the prowl. It was quieter now. No one paid me any special attention, although the street was alive with pedestrians, all moiling along in the mysterious tint of green. Perhaps I'm out of his territory at last, I thought, and began trying to place Reinhardt in the scheme of things. He's been around all the while, but I've been looking in another direction. He was around and others like him, but I had looked past him until Clifton's death, or was it Ross, had made me aware.
What on earth was hiding behind the face of things? If dark glasses and a white hat could blot out my identity so quickly, who, actually, was who? The perfume was exotic and seemed to roll up the walk behind me as I became aware of a woman strolling casually behind me.
"I've been waiting for you to recognize me, Daddy," a voice said. "I've been waiting for you a long time."
It was a pleasant voice with a slightly husky edge and plenty of sleep in it.
"Don't you hear me, Daddy?" she said.
And I started to look around, hearing,
"No, Daddy, don't look back. My old man might be cold trailing me. Just walk along beside me while I tell you where to meet me. I swear, I thought you'd never come. Will you be able to see me tonight?"
She had moved close to me now, and suddenly I felt a hand fumbling at my jacket pocket.
"All right, Daddy. You don't have to jump evil on me. Here it is. Now will you see me?"
I stopped dead, grabbing her hand and looking at her, an exotic girl even through the green glasses, looking at me with a smile that suddenly broke.
"Reinhardt, Daddy, what's the matter?"
So here it goes again, I thought, holding her tightly. "I'm not Reinhardt, miss," I said, "and for the first time tonight, I'm truly sorry."
"But Bliss, Daddy, Reinhardt, you're not trying to put your baby down. Daddy, what did I do?"
She seized my arm, and we were poised face to face in the middle of the walk. And suddenly she screamed,
"Oh, you really aren't. And me trying to give you his money? Get away from me, you dumb John. Get away from me."
I backed off. Her face was distorted as she stamped her high heels and screamed. Behind me, I heard someone say, "Hey, what was that?" Followed by the sound of running feet as I shot off and around the corner, away from her screams. That lovely girl, I thought. That lovely girl. Several blocks away, I stopped, out of breath, and both pleased and angry. How stupid could people be? Was everyone suddenly nuts? I looked about me. It was a bright street, the walks full of people. I stood at the curb, trying to breathe. Up the street, a sign with a cross glowed above the walk. "Holy Way Station. Behold the Living God." The letters glowed dark green, and I wondered if it were from the lenses or the actual color of the neon tubes. A couple of drunks stumbled past. I headed for Hambro's, passing a man sitting on the curb with his head bent over his knees. Cars passed. I went on. Two solemn-faced children came passing out handbills, which first I refused, then went back and took. After all, I had to know what was going on in the community. I took the bill and stepped close to the streetlight, reading, "Behold the invisible. Thy will be done, O Lord. I see all, know all, tell all, cure all. You shall see the unknown wonders. Reverend B.P. Reinhardt, spiritual technologist. The old is ever new. Way stations in New Orleans, the home of mystery, Birmingham, New York, Chicago, Detroit, and L.A. No problem too hard for God. Come to the way station. Behold the invisible. Attend our services, prayer meetings, thrice weekly. Join us in the new revelation of the old-time religion. Behold the seen unseen. Behold the invisible. Ye who are weary, come home. I do what you want done. Don't wait." I dropped the leaflet into the gutter and moved on. I walked slowly, my breath still coming hard. Could it be? Soon I reached the sign. It hung above a store that had been converted into a church, and I stepped into the shallow lobby and wiped my face with a handkerchief. Behind me I heard the rise and fall of an old-fashioned prayer such as I hadn't heard since leaving the campus, and then only when visiting country preachers were asked to pray. The voice rose and fell in a rhythmical, dream-like recital. Part enumeration of earthly trials undergone by the congregation, part rapt display of vocal virtuosity, part appeal to God. I was still wiping my face and squinting at crude biblical scenes painted on the windows when two old ladies came up to me.
"Even, Reverend Reinhardt,"
one of them said.
"How's our dear pastor this warm evening?"
Oh, no, I thought, but perhaps agreeing will cause less trouble than denying, I said.
good evening, sisters,"
muffling my voice with my handkerchief and catching the odor of the girl's perfume from my hand.
"This here is Sister Harris, Reverend," She come to join our little band.
God bless you, Sister Harris, I said, taking her extended hand.
You know, Reverend, I once heard you preach years ago. You was just a little old 12-year-old boy back in Virginia, and here I come north and find you. Praise God. Still preaching the gospel, doing the Lord's work, still preaching the old-time religion here in this wicked city. Sister Harris, the other sister said, we better get on in and find our seats. Besides, the pastor's kind of got things to do, though you are here a little early, aren't you, Reverend?
Yes, I said, dabbing my mouth with my handkerchief. They were motherly old women of the southern type, and I suddenly felt a nameless despair. I wanted to tell them that Reinhardt was a fraud. But now there came a shout from inside the church, and I heard a burst of music.
Just listen to it, Sister Harris. That's the new kind of guitar music I told you Reverend Reinhardt got for us. Ain't it heavenly? Praise God, Sister Harris said. Praise God. Excuse us, Reverend. I have to see Sister Judkins about the money she collected for the building fund. And, Reverend, last night I sold 10 recordings of your inspiring sermon. Even sold one to the white lady I work for.
Bless you, I found myself saying in a voice heavy with despair. Bless you. Bless you. Then the door opens, and I look past their heads into a small, crowded room of men and women sitting in folding chairs. To the front, where a slender woman in a rusty black robe played passionate boogie-woogie on an upright piano, along with a young man wearing a skullcap who struck righteous riffs from an electric guitar which was connected to an amplifier that hung from the ceiling above a gleaming white and gold pulpit. A man in an elegant red cardinal's robe and a high lace collar stood resting against an enormous Bible and now began to lead a hard-driving hymn which the congregation shouted in the unknown tongue. And back, and high on the wall above him, there arched the words in letters of gold, Let there be light. The whole scene quivered vague and mysterious in the green light. Then the door closed and the sound muted down. It was too much for me. I removed my glasses and tucked the white hat carefully beneath my arm and walked away. Can it be, I thought. Can it actually be? And I knew that it was. I had heard of it before, but I'd never come so close. Still, could he be all of them? Rhine the runner and Rhine the gambler and Rhine the briber and Rhine the lover and Reinhardt the reverend? Could he himself be both Rind and heart? What is real, anyway? But how could I doubt it? He was a broad man, a man of parts who got around, Reinhardt the rounder. It was true, as I was true. His world was possibility, and he knew it. He was years ahead of me, and I was a fool. I must have been crazy and blind. The world in which we lived was without boundaries. A vast, seething, hot world of fluidity, and Rhine the rascal was at home. Perhaps only Rhine the rascal was at home in it. It was unbelievable, but perhaps only the unbelievable could be believed. Perhaps the truth was always a lie. Perhaps I thought the whole thing should roll off me like drops of water rolling off Jack's glass eye. I should search out the proper political classification, label Reinhardt and his situation, and quickly forget it. I hurried away from the church so swiftly that I found myself back at the office before I remembered that I was going to Hambrose. I was both depressed and fascinated. I wanted to know Reinhardt, and yet I thought, I'm upset because I know I don't have to know him. That simply becoming aware of his existence, being mistaken for him, is enough to convince me that Reinhardt is real. It couldn't be, but it is. And it can be, is, simply because it's unknown. Jack wouldn't dream of such a possibility, nor Tobit, who thinks he's so close. Too little was known, too much was in the dark. I thought of Clifton and of Jack himself. How much was really known about either of them? How much was known about me? Who from my old life had challenged me? And after all this time, I had just discovered Jack's missing eye. My entire body started to itch as though I had just been removed from a plaster cast and was unused to the new freedom of movement.
In the South, everyone knew you, but coming north was a jump into the unknown. How many days could you walk the streets of the big city without encountering anyone who knew you? And how many nights? You could actually make yourself anew. The notion was